The Virginia Voice presents Richmond storyteller Denise Bennett, telling stories of Christmas.
This first story is called Magnificat, and it's a story that I wrote. This dress makes me look like Little Bo Peep. That's what I'm thinking as I'm standing outside behind the high school waiting for the bus to come. It's my choir uniform, so at least I'm not the only one who looks like a dork. It's a long navy blue polyester number with puff sleeves and this big white square collar that would do the Pilgrim Fathers proud. The boys don't have it so bad. They're wearing white shirts and dark pants and little bow ties. We're on our way down to the First Federal Bank building, where every year they set up risers in the marble foyer, and all the choirs from the high schools and the junior highs come down to spread Christmas cheer to the customers. They also film it and show it on one of the local stations, so you have to be careful not to pick your nose or scratch your... Well, anyway... I have my jean jacket on over the dress, so it's not so bad. But it's really too hot to have the jacket on. I mean, it's December, and it must be, what, like 75? That's how hot it was last year on Christmas. But that's what you get in Montgomery, Alabama. You'd be lucky if you got a heavy frost on Christmas, never mind a white Christmas. Well, the weather and a few other things are really not helping me to get into the Christmas spirit. Usually, the music helps, but this year, Miss Grayson, our choir teacher, has chosen unusually difficult pieces. Well, not that I'm not up to a challenge. I mean, I was in a by-audition-only choir in the summer, and we sang all these hard pieces by Mozart and Handel and this weird guy named Charles Ives, and I loved it. But the school choir, well, anybody can be in it, and you don't have to be able to read music, and I think half of them don't. And so I guess that's why, come November, Ms. Grayson noticed that the altos were really struggling, and so she asked me if I would sing alto just for the Christmas concert. I know I should have been flattered. I mean, it was a compliment, really, but I just couldn't help but feel like somehow I'd been demoted. You know, like maybe people were thinking, well, she's singing alto because she can't really hit all the high notes. And, well, see, this is my senior year, and everything's supposed to be perfect your senior year. But it's not. Right then, the bus pulls up, and we all clamber on, and I sit down on the hard red vinyl seat next to the window, and Sharon Miller gets on and sits down next to me. Well, immediately she leans over and points out the window. Look, Denise, there's Carol Eunice late again. I look over and I see Carol getting out of her car. Carol is this tall, really skinny girl with sort of big pop eyes. And, well, I always think she kind of looks like olive oil from Popeye. And Sharon says, yeah. I think she's late again because she was up all night doing you-know-what with Ricky Forbes. Ricky Forbes, I say? You're kidding. I don't know how Sharon knows all this stuff. It's like she knows the dirt on people before they even know it. Ricky Forbes is probably a really nice guy. I really don't know him, but I think he's been shaving since he was 7 years old, and... he's got more hair on his back than some guys have on their heads. The idea of him and skinny little Carol, ooh. Well, I say to Sharon, I guess Carol will be having a very hairy Christmas. Sharon begins to laugh. You're so funny, Denise, she says. And then I say, you know, Sharon, I really need to look at my music. I don't quite have the alto line down on the Magnificat, and I open my folder, but Sharon is not done. She points in front of us. Look, Denise, there's Brian and Cindy. I unwillingly look up and see my old boyfriend, Brian, sitting on the seat next to Cindy. Brian and I went out for a whole year, but I broke up with him in September. See, maybe it had been going on all along, but I really noticed it in July. He was acting like he owned me. See, we'd gone to the school. The student council was doing this project where they were taking pictures and they were going to make a calendar and sell it as a fundraiser. And Brian and I were supposed to be the picture for April. We were going to sit under an umbrella and it would say April showers. So we went, and of course they were running late like they always do, and so we sat on the steps and we were waiting, and after a minute or two, Brian said he had to go to the bathroom, so he went inside the building, and that was when Tim Hollis came up and he sat down beside me and he started telling me jokes, and he is so funny. I was just laughing and laughing, and then it occurred to me, where was Brian? He'd been gone for a long time. So I turned around and I looked at the school building, and there, glaring at me through the door, was Brian. Well, Tim turned around, and he took one look at Brian's face, and he got up and left in a hurry. Brian came out then, but he didn't say a word. He just sat down, not very close, and just, you could see the steam rising off of him, so I said, "What's wrong?" "As if you didn't know," he said. "I don't know," I said. "What's the matter?" "I'm not gone for 5 minutes, and you're out here flirting with another guy." "Are you kidding, Tim? Flirting with me?" "Brian, I don't think Tim even likes girls, if you know what I mean. But nothing I said would change his mind. He was just sure that I was trying to find somebody else to run off with or something, and... well, we had the picture taken with these big phony smiles plastered on our faces, and when the calendar came out, they really should have captioned it April Thunderstorms. Well, things just went from bad to worse after that, and I broke up with him in September. Oh, it was terrible. He cried, I cried, and ever since then, if I should ever, by accident, end up looking at him, he quickly looks away, but not before he's given me this look that says, "I hate you." I said, "I think he's just going out with her because she looks like you." Sharon's voice snaps me out of my reverie. "Oh, I don't know, Sharon," I say. I guess our hair is kind of the same, but really... she's very pretty. She's got a better figure than I do, and she's a really nice girl. I'm sure that's why he's going out with her. I'm sure I sound like little Miss Goody Two-Shoes, but then I say to her again, "Look, I really have to look at this music. I just don't know this alto line." Sharon says, "Oh, Denise, just relax. You'll be fine." Easy for her to say. She's singing soprano. I look down at the music. Magnificat. Anima meo dominum. My soul doth magnify the Lord. That's what the words mean. But what does it really mean? I mean, I guess if some big angel with white wings came to me and told me that I was going to bear God's son, and then I went to see my old cousin, and she said, "Blessed art thou among women," maybe I too would sing Magnificat Anima Meo Dominum. No, I wouldn't. I'd say, "Holy crap, why me?" You know, they never tell you in the Bible whether Mary had any doubts. I mean... did she just know that everything was going to be okay? What would that be like? To be so overcome by something, something bigger than yourself, that it could just push all your doubts aside. Well, just then, I hear Brian talking to Ed, one of the tenors, about some football game they saw on TV over the weekend. Guys ever talk about anything other than sports? Oh, well, what do I care? Brian's cultural improvement is no longer my project. let Cindy try to get him to go to movies that don't have car chases and explosions in them. I'm looking at the back of him. He's wearing the jean jacket that I embroidered for him. I remember how last Christmas I was working on that jacket, and with every stitch, I thought to myself, oh, he's going to love this. Oh, but maybe he won't. I take another stitch. Oh, he's going to love it. Oh, maybe he won't. Well, I guess he did love it, since he's still wearing it. I wonder if Cindy knows that. As I watch him lean over and whisper her something in her ear, I wonder for the gazillionth time if I did the right thing, breaking up with him. Oh, everything would be all right if I could just get into the Christmas spirit. Maybe I need a visitation like Ebenezer Scrooge. But I've already been thinking about one Christmas past, and that's not helping. I remember what it was like when I was little. We had this aluminum Christmas tree. Okay, now I know that those are kind of tacky, but back then, I just thought it was so beautiful. It had all these sparkly ornaments on it, and there was this thing called a color wheel, and it rotated, and it had different colored panels on it and would shine on the tree and turn it red or green or blue or yellow. It was so cool, and I can remember I loved to sit in the living room with all the lights off and just look at that tree. My mother would put on the Reader's Digest Christmas album, and everybody was on there. I mean, there was Spike Jonze singing All I Want for Christmas Is My Two Front Teeth. And Enrico Caruso singing, Oh, Holy Night. It was beautiful. I stare out the window. The bus is moving by now, of course, and we're coming through a poorer part of town. I wonder what Christmas future will be like. The only picture I can conjure up is myself sitting all alone in this little apartment in a faded aqua house dress with this gray sweater on with a tiny hole in the elbow. There's this little fake Christmas tree on the coffee table, and I have my only present, a set of tea towels from my brother. I turn on the radio, and it's the Magnificat, the piece that we're working on, and I hear that soprano line soaring. And in my daydream, I try to sing it, but my voice is old and quavery like my grandma's. It cracks. And I know it's stupid. I can't help it, but a tear slides out of my eye, and I'm so glad that I'm sitting next to the window so Sharon won't see. Why should I be so miserable? Just because I don't have a boyfriend? Just because I'm not having a Hallmark Christmas? The bus stops. We've hit some traffic or something, and I'm looking out the window, and the scene there is not pretty. There's this old cinder block garage with this corrugated tin roof that's sort of covered with rust, and this old junk car. Great, I think. The scene looks just the way I feel. And I start to turn away, but it's like something inside me says, no, keep looking. And so I do. I keep looking, and I keep looking. And somehow, I don't know what happens, but I see things for the first time. I know that sounds strange, but it's like I'm looking at the corrugated tin roof, and it's like I can see this pattern in the rust. I mean, I'm not crazy. It's just that I notice it. Like it looks like the rust makes this drawing, like water coming down over a waterfall, over rocks. And I can see every little crack and crevice in the cinder blocks. And even the chipped paint around the door frame is fascinating. Well, I keep looking, and I look at that junked car. There's not a bit of original paint left on it, but there are still places where the chrome shines, and there's light and dark. It's like a work of art. I can't explain it, but I'm just seeing it. Really seeing it. Well, I don't know how long I stare at it. Really, it was kind of like time stopped. But finally, we move on, and I turn around to the rest of the people on the bus, and I know this sounds really corny, but I'm just filled with love for all of them. It's like I'm seeing them all for the first time, too. And I look at Sharon, and she looks at me, and I smile at her. I really smile. Not, you know, kind of like halfway smile like I usually do, always holding something back. And I think to myself, she just talks about people because she's afraid. She kind of looks at me, and she tilts her head, and like she's not sure what's going on, but she smiles, too. Well, the bus moves on, but then suddenly, I guess somebody came out in front of him, so he has to slam on the brakes, and half the girls on the bus scream, and Leon Johnson, he's this big football player, falls down and sits on his butt in the aisle, and then everybody laughs. But my music goes sailing out of my lap, and it lands two seats up on the other side, right under Brian's seat. I excuse myself and climb over Sharon, and I'm kneeling there in the aisle to pick up my music. Brian turns and he looks at me, and I said, my music is under your seat. And he smiles, but it's kind of an anxious, tentative smile, and he says, well, that's a silly place to keep it. And I smile back. He bends down and he picks it up and he hands it to me and he says, you know, the altos sound really good, especially since November. And I don't know what to say, so I just smile and I say, thank you. And I go back to my seat, and it's like this heavy load has been lifted off my shoulders, and I don't really understand what's happened, but something has. I look back down at the words of the Magnificat, at the line of music, and suddenly I can hear how perfectly the alto line complements the soprano. Magnificat. Anima meo, Dominum. Somehow, I understand.
You're listening to Richmond storyteller Denise Spinett on Virginia Voice. She's telling the stories of Christmas.
This story is called Angels and Other Strangers. It's from a collection of short stories by the same title by Catherine Patterson. Minutes after Jacob got the letter from Arlene, he set out walking for Washington. He wondered how long it would take him. Back before the truck died, he could make it in an hour. He was 60, and he knew that his endurance was not what it once was, but he was still strong. If he kept up a steady pace, maybe he could make it by morning, or at least get somewhere where he could catch a bus that would carry him as far as the few dollars in his pocket would allow. But Arlene needed him, and he would walk every step of the way if he had to. Arlene, his baby granddaughter, who it seemed he'd only just stopped bouncing on his knee, was going to have a baby herself, and she was all alone and scared in the city, and she wanted her granddaddy. So he put on his dead wife's overcoat and his own overcoat over that, and he set out. The coats kept the wet snow away from him, but his wife's coat was too small, and it cut him under the arms. But as he walked along, he said, I'm coming, Arlene, baby. I'm coming. I'm going to be with you for Christmas. Wouldn't it be wonderful if somebody would offer him a ride? Even on this lonely stretch of country road, there had been a few cars that had gone by, and at one point he even thought to raise his hands over his head and flag one down, but then he thought better of it. Who was going to give a ride to an old black man on a deserted country road? Hope in the Lord, but trust your own two feet. No rest for the weary, as the good book said. Now in Washington, Julia Thompson was singing as she worked. Why was she so happy? Well, she had two beautiful children, a loving husband. That night, her husband, Walter, was going to sing at the Christmas Eve service, and she was always so thrilled and proud whenever she heard his voice. And it was almost Christmas. Yes, all of those things were making her happy. But most of all, this year, for the first time since she had known Walter, she was not going to have to put up with Aunt Patty. Aunt Patty was Walter's only living relative, and as such, she deserved some respect. But there always seemed to be trouble whenever she was around. Now, most years, it was just that she grumbled through the holiday, taking the edge off of everybody else's enjoyment. But the last 3 years, well, now, you could hardly blame an old lady for falling in front of the church and breaking her hip on Christmas Eve, and they had to call the ambulance, of course. But then the following year, shouldn't she have known not to give a 2-year-old a teddy bear that had button eyes that he could and would pull off and swallow, thus meaning that they had to spend all of Christmas Day in the emergency room? And then last year, well, there was no major disaster last year, and Julia was a little apprehensive. But still, everything went all right until she and Walter, in their excitement, told Aunt Patty that they were going to have another child. Aunt Patty had never before displayed a social conscience. But when they told her about the coming baby, all of a sudden she began to lament about all the hungry people in the world. And here she and Walter were going to bring another one to push all those poor hungry people away from the table. But this year, she had decided what with the weather forecast and her bursitis had been bothering her, she was just going to stay out in the country at Bethel. And so Julia had found that she was filled with a new energy. She shopped, she cooked, she baked, she cleaned the house. She even had enough energy to take the children on long walks and to read to Kevin. Well, after she put the baby down for her nap, she took Kevin and they went upstairs. Kevin was 4 years old. They sat on her bed and she began to read him stories. Now, normally he loved to be read to, but today he was so wriggly, he wriggled and squirmed all the way through. 'Twas the night before Christmas, until Julia looked down at him and said, "My, you're fidgety." Kevin looked up at her and said with great dignity, "Little boys are supposed to be fidgety." "Well, now, try to pay attention. I'm going to read you the story from the Bible about how Jesus was born." "All right." Well, she told him the part about how Mary and Joseph went from Nazareth down to Bethlehem, stopping to explain, of course, about the emperor and the taxes and the manger. And then she got to the part about the shepherds. "And the angel of the Lord appeared before them, and lo, the glory of the Lord shone about them, and they were sore afraid." The glory, that means it was a big light. "Why were they afraid?" Kevin said. "Well, I guess because of that big light, and they'd never seen an angel before, and, well, it was so strange." Well, that seemed to satisfy him, and so she read. But she noticed as she read on that his head was beginning to nod, and so she read the rest of the chapter very quietly. And when he was asleep, she brought pillows around him on the bed, and she went downstairs to clean up the lunch things and to make sure everything was ready for that night. And that was when she noticed that she didn't have any tangerines. Now, maybe it was silly. Kevin was only 4, and Jenny, the baby, was not even 5 months yet. So maybe it was silly, but somehow a stocking without a tangerine in the toe just didn't seem right. And she wanted everything to be perfect this Christmas. So she called Becky, the teenager next door, to come over and watch the children while she ran to the grocery store. She was back in 20 minutes, and when she got back, she said to Becky, "Everything all right?" Becky said, "Fine, all quiet." "Oh, but your aunt called." Julia's heart sank. "She says she wants Mr. Thompson to come and pick her up. She changed her mind about coming for Christmas." Now, what Julia should have done was just asked Becky to stay. And she should have gone right then and there to pick up Aunt Patty. But she didn't do that. She sent Becky home after she'd paid her, and then she thought to herself, "Is there any way I can pretend that I didn't get the message?" No. No, that wouldn't be right. So she picked up the phone and she called Walter's office. It was 3:30, and if he left right now, he could go out to the country, pick up Aunt Patty, and be back in time for the rehearsal. But when she called the office, Walter wasn't there. This was in the days before cell phones, and his secretary said he had gone out to investigate an accident that had occurred at the Virginia plant, and if he called the office, she would tell him to call home. That wasn't going to work. Julia thought to herself, now, nobody would expect me to load 2 sleeping children into the car at this time of the afternoon when it looks like it's going to snow. Well, just then the phone rang. Of course, it was Aunt Patty. "Now, Julia, just forget that I called. I don't want Walter coming out when it looks like it's going to snow, and will you all just have a nice Christmas, and I'll just be here by myself." Well, just then, Kevin came padding down the hall in his stocking feet. He was still sleepy, and he rubbed his eyes, and he said, "Who's on the phone, Mommy?" And Julia said, "Aunt Patty." Well, all of a sudden, Kevin's face lit up, and he said, "Aunt Patty, oh boy, she's coming for Christmas." And Julia said into the phone, "It's all right, Aunt Patty. We'll come and get you right away." "Well, now, I think that's just silly, Julia. I don't want you, but, well, if you insist, click." So Julia got Jenny and Kevin. She put them into the car, and they began to drive out to the country. Now, if the weather really had been threatening, if it had been the least bit slippery, she would have turned around and gone back home. But truthfully, it wasn't that bad. There was just a little light snow falling. What she hadn't counted on was how much traffic there was on the interstate. People were stopping and starting and beeping. And it was finally, well, half an hour later, when they finally got off the interstate, and that they began to make some good time on the country road. Julia looked down at the gas gauge. It was dangerously low. But there was a gas station just this side of Aunt Patty's house. She'd stop there and fill up, and everything would be fine. But when she got to the gas station, it was closed for the Christmas holiday. Well, nothing to do but drive on. Now, as they drove, Kevin sang songs. He sang songs about Santa Claus, but he substituted Aunt Patty's name. "Here comes Aunt Patty, here comes Aunt Patty, right down Aunt Patty Lane." And Julia thought to herself, well, at least I deserve some credit for not turning Kevin against her. When they finally pulled up into Aunt Patty's driveway, Julia said to Kevin, "Now you just stay in the car with Jenny, and I'll be right back out with Aunt Patty." So she went in, she went around the back of the house, and she knocked on the door. And no one answered. She knocked again. Still no answer. So finally she tried the doorknob and it popped open. That didn't seem right. She went into the house. "Aunt Patty? Aunt Patty?" One of Aunt Patty's cats came down the steps. It meowed menacingly, and Julia thought, oh no, what if she's lying here somewhere in the house? What if she's sick or worse? But as she looked around, she saw a note on the kitchen table. She went over and read it. Walter, I've just gone down to Gertrude's house. You can either pick me up there, or you can wait here until I get back. I'll just be a minute. Love, Aunt Patty. Well, Julia thought to herself, Gertrude, I don't know who that is. I don't even have a last name, so I can look it up in the phone book. Wasn't this just like Aunt Patty? Well, Julia went out the house. She went back, and she got in the car, and she began to back out of the driveway. Kevin said, where's Aunt Patty, Mama? She went to a friend's house. We'll just go and get some gas, and then we'll come back and get her. Well, why'd she go? Didn't she know we were coming? I don't know why she went, Kevin. She didn't say. Well, was she there? No, Kevin, she wasn't there. Why, Mommy? I don't know, Kevin. Mommy, why are you yelling at me? I'm sorry, sweetheart. Look, I have to look at the road. They drove on. Now, somewhere out here, there was a road that cut over to the subdivision, and she knew there was a gas station out there, but, well, she never actually drove when she came out here, and everything looked so unfamiliar at night. If Walter were here, he'd know where to go, and she didn't dare look at the gas gauge. Mommy, why are we stopped? Julia put her head on the steering wheel. Now, Kevin, I don't want you to get upset. I've got to stay calm, she thought to herself. I have two young children to take care of. Well, just at that moment, the baby woke up and began to scream. Mommy, the baby's awake. Yes, dear, I know. I started to say, I don't want you to get upset, but we've run out of gas. I'm not upset, Mommy. Jenny's upset. I'm fidgety. Yes, sweetheart, I know. You can get out of your car seat. And she leaned back and she unbuckled the car seat, and Kevin clambered happily over the front seat. Okay, first things first, Julia thought. I'll feed the baby. And so she got Jenny out of the car seat and brought her into the front and began to nurse her. And Kevin was a little jealous that he couldn't have his supper right then, so they began to sing Christmas songs, from all his favorites from his records, to distract him. And as they were sitting there singing, that's when they saw the light coming over the hill. And they just finished the verse when Kevin said, look, Mommy, glory stream from heaven afar. Jacob had seen the lights of the car coming up over the hill from a distance. But he didn't think anything about it. Didn't matter. They were going the wrong way for him anyway. But now as he came up over the hill, he saw that a car was stopped by the side of the road. And as he got closer, shining his big flashlight into the car, he could see there were people there. Was it a trick? He wasn't afraid to die. Lord knows he was ready to go any time the good Lord wanted him. But Arlene needed him. She needed him now. But still, here were some other people who maybe needed help too. And he came over to the car. As the light got closer and closer, Julia could see the shape of a man behind the light, a tall, bulky shape. She quickly looked to see that all the doors were locked on the car, and she took the baby off her breast and adjusted her clothes. As the light got closer and closer, she looked, and it blinded her for a moment. And then there was this face staring at her through the side window, this black face that seemed to fill up the whole window. And she could see gray stubble on his chin, and he was missing a few teeth. And he tapped on the window with threadbare gloves. Mommy, Mommy, look, it's the glory light, Kevin said. Julia just sat there, gripping the baby close to her. She wouldn't look at the man. She was not going to turn her head. Kevin, shh. We don't know what he wants. But, Mommy, he wants to help us. Can't you hear? And indeed, the man was saying, do y'all need help? And then he said, don't be afraid, little lady. Did you hear that, Kevin said? That's what angels say, Mommy. And before she could stop him, he had slid across the seat, pulled up the button, and was out and running around the front of the car. Well, the man crossed to meet the boy. And Julia rolled down her window, don't touch my child. He looked at her and he said, well, lady, do you want me to let him run into the road? No. No. No, thank you. Thank you. The little boy looked up at him and said, our car run out of gas. Julia looked at the man. He was very big. He looked very strong. She thought about a police pamphlet that she'd seen. Be sure to get a good look at your assailant so you can describe him later to the police. If there was a later. Oh, please, she thought, please don't let him hurt me. Please don't let him hurt my children. Jacob looked at this woman. Why was she so afraid of him? He who had never hurt the least of God's creatures. The little boy knew he didn't mean them any harm. He looked down at the child and he said, so, your old car's got an empty belly, huh? Well, we'll have to see what we can do about that. He tapped on the window again and Julia looked at him. Do you have a can? He said, there's a gas station a ways back. I'll go and get you some gas. Julia said, oh, well, no, I don't have a can. I said, well, that's all right. I'll borrow from the one from the gas station. He took the child back to the car, and he said, now you get in here with your mom. And he said, you better roll the window up. I can see you're shivering. And whether it was from fear or the cold, who could say? I'll be back as soon as I can. As he began to walk back up the hill, Julia said, wait, do you need some money? He said, no, that's all right. He didn't want to waste the energy walking back down and then up that hill again. Julia rolled the window back up. What did he want? If he'd wanted her purse, he could have taken it right then and there. No, no, that was stupid. Of course, he wanted the car, but it didn't have any gas in it. So he had to get gas so he could steal the car. And she began to sing Christmas songs with Kevin, partly to distract him and partly to calm herself down. And she wasn't sure how much time had passed, but after a while, she saw the light appear again over the hill. The man came, and she rolled down the window. He said, can you hold the flashlight so I can see to pour it into the gas tank? All right, she said, and she got out, and she tried to hold it steady with her hands, not to shake too much. After they had finished filling the tank, she said, here, let me give you something for your trouble. And she pulled some money out and held it out toward him. Jacob thought to himself, that's all she's going to do? She's just going to shove money at me? After I've given her almost an hour of my time and who knows how much of my energy. He said, no, that's all right. But then he said, but I do need to take the can back. He could see that she did not want to let him in the car. But he didn't care. He was too tired, and he had to get to Arlene's house that night, or at least by morning. So he came around, and he sat down. She put the children back in the car seats, and they began to drive. She put her purse down on the seat between them. He looked down, and he saw that she saw him looking at the purse, and he looked away very quickly. They got to the gas station, and she could see the attendant looking questioningly at the man sitting in the front seat, and she thought to herself, well, Should I say something? Should I... But it just seemed foolish. After all, the man had been nothing but kind to them, and if he'd wanted to take the car, he would have taken it by now. If he'd wanted to take her purse, he could have done that. So she didn't say anything. She got back into the car, and she said, "Well, where can I take you?" Jacob thought to himself, if she'd just been the least bit friendly, the least bit trusting, he would have said to her, "I need to go to Washington." But she wasn't, and he couldn't bring himself to ask. So he just mumbled, just anywhere, go on. They drove along, and they'd driven past the place where they'd stopped. And so Julia, not hearing anything from him, kept on driving. She pulled into the driveway of Aunt Patty's house, and the problem of leaving the man alone with the children was solved when Aunt Patty came tearing out of the house. Julia rolled down the window. "Where have you been? You're going to make me late for the music." Well, just at that moment, the man got out of the car and stood up against the night sky. When Aunt Patty saw him, she screamed. Kevin clambered over his mother into the front seat and said, "Aunt Patty, look, it's our Christmas angel." "Christmas angel? Well, I've never heard anything so ridiculous," she said. Ridiculous? Well, suddenly all of Julia's fear just fell away. Ridiculous, indeed. Why, he had been an angel. He had done nothing but help them. She turned to the man and she said, "Do you mind getting into the back seat with the children?" She turned back to Aunt Patty. She said, "Aunt Patty, get in the car. You're going to make us late." Aunt Patty got into the car, still mumbling to herself, and the man got into the back with the children. He let Kevin tell him how to buckle his car seat. As they drove on, Julia said, "Now, where do you need to go?" He said, "Well, I need to go to Washington if it's not out of your way." She said, "That'd be fine." And Kevin said, "Washington, that's where we live. You can come to our church. We never had a real angel at church before." And the man began to laugh. He said, "Well, young man, I think I've got to go and cheer up a little girl tonight. She's real sad at Christmas time." He said, "Oh, angels are really busy, aren't they?" And he laughed again. It was a rich, deep sound that filled the entire car. He said, "Yes, we're busy, but it's a real pleasant kind of work." Julia could hear Aunt Patty mumbling under her breath, "Ridiculous." But she just smiled. It was going to be a perfect Christmas.
You're listening to storyteller Denise Bennett, telling stories of Christmas.
This last story is a Serbian folk tale that was adapted by Ruth Sawyer, and this is my adaptation of it yet again. It's called This Was the Christmas. It was midsummer when the floods came raging through the valley, swelling the river to overflowing. All night long, the men worked, driving the cattle and the sheep up to higher ground. And at the end of the night, when the sun came up, not a single life had been lost, and one had been gained. He was on a rock over the raging flood of the river. Whatever clothes he had been wearing had been swept away in the flood. He was barely 2 years old, dark hair, dark skin, and a few words that he was mumbling, babbling to himself, were of the gypsy tongue. It was Janovic, one of the farmers of the valley, who found him and carried him back to his home. When Mother Janovic saw him, her arms went out to him, as any mother's would. But Janovic said, "We are not going to keep him. He is Cigani, one of the gypsies." But Mother Janovic took him into her lap, and she fed him out of her own porridge bowl. She said, "He is little and helpless. You found him. It was God's will that we keep him. And look," she said. She waved her hand in front of the boy's face. He did not blink. She picked up the candle that still burned on the table and held it so close to the boy's face that it almost singed his long, dark lashes. But still, he had no reaction. "You see," she said, "he is blind. We will take care of him. It is God's will." And for that day only, she held him close to her heart. But he was not one of them. Oh, they took care of him. They gave him plenty of food. They gave him clothing to wear. But he was not one of them. They named him Marco, partly in mockery because it was the name of one of their epic heroes, but also because he had a way with animals like Marco in the epic poems. Even as a young child, the birds would come and feed from his hands. And if there was a wounded hare or fox, the boy seemed to know what to do to help them heal. And so from an early age, Janovic set him to take care of the sheep. During the summer, he slept with the sheep in the pastures. In the winter, he brought them in and he slept with them in the shed. Though he could not see, his other senses compensated, and he knew on that little patch of earth, every rock, every tree, he knew every sheep by the feel of it and the smell and the sound, but he was not one of them. When he was about 6 years old, there was an old shepherd from Dalmatia who was traveling through, and seeing a fellow shepherd out in the pastures, he stopped to talk with the boy. When he saw that the boy was blind, he decided to stay a little longer, and he took out his flute, and he played. He played song after song, and the boy was enchanted. And after the old shepherd had gone on, the boy searched until he found a willow reed, and he made his own flute, and he taught himself how to play it. People would stop sometimes as they passed through that area of pasture. They would stop and listen to the wild, sweet music that the boy played. And sometimes a stranger might hear one of the farmers singing a song, and he'd say, "Friend, where does that song come from? It's beautiful, but I've never heard it before." And they'd say, "Oh, well, it's the gypsy boy who lives among us. He made it up. Of course, he is a gypsy. He's not really one of us." On Sundays, that was the hardest day for Marco, because on Sundays the family would get ready and they would go to church. But when he asked if he might go, they said, "No, it is not for you. It is not for Sigani." But they didn't explain why. It was the old priest who did. He was coming back from a parishioner's house one day, and he saw the boy there in the pastures, and he was a kind, simple man, and so he sat down to talk to him. He thought, even if he couldn't go to church, that he should know something about God. As they talked, the boy said, "I hear the Janovics say their prayers." He said, "And so God, he is the big king." "Yes," said the old priest, "you may call him that." "And his son, the Christ, he is the small king?" "Yes, yes, certainly." "And his mother, Mary, she is very holy." "Yes, that's right." "And they live in the church yonder?" The priest said, "No, their images are in the church. They live in heaven." "But if I went in the church, I could feel their images, and then I could know what they look like." And the old priest sighed. No. No, my son, you could not go into the church. You see, well, the people of the valley would never allow it. They say that when the Holy Family, the Christ and his mother Mary and Joseph, when they fled from Judea into Egypt, the gypsies, the Egyptians, they would not give them shelter. And because of this, they say that they are cursed, cursed forever. And you are one of them. And so you cannot come into the church, my son. I'm sorry. You bear the mark of the outcast, I'm afraid. Marco said, after he took a deep breath, Father, show me where this mark is. Put my hand on it, and I will cut it out. Then I can go to the church. But the old priest shook his head. No, my son. I am sorry. It is not a mark on your body. It is a mark on your soul. Oh. The boy was silent for a long time. And then he said, Why do you call me my son? And the old priest sighed even more deeply. Truly, I do not know. I am a simple man. I don't know anything. Marco grew. On the bitterest days, the family would allow him to come into the house. But he was not one of them. The year that he was 12, that was when it happened. Christmas was always such a hard time for him. It was the most joyous occasion of the year. Every year at Christmas, a boy was chosen from the village who would go to each house. And he would knock on the door, and the lady of the house would scatter wheat on the floor, and the boy would come in, and he would say, The Christ is born. And the woman would reply, Truly, he is born. And then the boy would go to the log, the Christ log, in the fireplace, and he would hit it with a stick, and when the sparks would fly up in the chimney, he would say, Let there be cattle and sheep and grain, as many as the sparks flying up the chimney. And thus he would pronounce a blessing for each house and for the whole village. Marco longed so much to just once be that boy who could bless the whole village. On Christmas Eve that year, he had gathered all the sheep into the shed. But as he went to each one of them and touched them to make sure that they were all there, he noticed that one of them was missing. As he went out of the shed, he could hear Mother Janovic calling to her children, Come, Drago! Come, Vuk! Come, Ivor! It's time to get ready to go to Mass! Oh, if only once she would say, Come, Marco! He shrugged, and he kept walking, listening carefully until he found the little ewe lamb. She had gotten herself caught up in a thorn bush, and in her panic, she had hurt one of her legs, and so he took her out of the thorn bush and wrapped her leg with strips of cloth torn from his own tunic, and then he put her up on his shoulders, and he carried her back to the shed. He settled down in the straw, and he said, I've heard the story, you know. On this night, the Christ, he was born in a place like this. A shed with sheep and cows. And there were shepherds like me. You and I, we will keep the Christmas Eve. Together, we will. And he pulled out his flute and he began to play songs one after the other. Around 11 o'clock, he heard the bells ringing, calling the people to midnight mass. And a great sorrow welled up in him. He was never bitter, but he was sad. He stopped playing, and he said, Oh, big king, could you just send somebody to speak for me to the people so that just once I could go into the church. Just once I could be part of Christmas, that I could have a place at the table on Christmas Day. I don't know if you hear my prayers. I'm a gypsy, but now maybe he fell asleep. Who knows? But it wasn't long after that that he felt a hand on his shoulder and a voice. "Does God always hear prayers so quickly?" he said. And the voice said, "Some prayers." "Who are you?" "I am one like yourself." "What, blind?" "No, but think. Are you really blind? Do you, with your hearing that hears the music in the wind, in the water tumbling over the rocks, don't you see more than people who have regular sight? Think. "I'm thinking," he said, "but I would see everything in the world." "No one sees that," said the voice. "I know this. I would see the face of the small king." And the voice said, "Put out your hands." And Marco stretched out his hands, and he felt the forehead, the eyes, the nose, the cheeks, the chin. His fingers lingered till he had memorized every feature. The voice said, "Now tell me, would you trade what you can do with your music for being able to see as others do?" And the boy's face was alight with joy, and he said, No. I will keep my music." And then he took out his flute, and he began to play. Just then, the bells rang. It was the end of Mass. Christmas morning had come, and the villagers came out of the church. They looked around. They saw that the sky was filled with light. Someone said, "It's coming from that direction." No, said another, "from over there." But the priest said, "It's coming from the Janovics farm." And all the villagers followed him down the road until they came to the shed. When they opened the door, they fell silent. For there, in the straw before them, was Marco, his face filled with joy. And one who was so suffused in light, he could only be the Christ. They fell to their knees. But Marco began to sing. "This is the Christmas to Mary most blessed. Jesus the Savior is born. These are the angels singing in heaven. All curses forgiven this morn. These are the shepherds, they seek for the stranger. They come to the manger to pray. And I, a poor shepherd, give praise to the great king. Give praise to the small king this day." It was the old priest who finally spoke, and he said, "It is we who have been blind." And as they all knelt there in worship at this miracle that had come to their little valley, Marco kept singing and singing and singing into the morning.
Denise Bennett on the Virginia Voice.